Good morning. It is wonderful to be here with you. Thank you.
Last Sunday, an Episcopal priest made history at the Washington National Cathedral. Reverend Cameron Partridge is the first openly transgender person to preach from its pulpit.
So often the worlds we live in have either failed to see us, have stared at us, or have sought to erase us. In the midst of this wilderness, we have needed to support and galvanize one another. I join with you in creating spaces for you to be and become who you are.
And on June 19th, the Presbyterian Church voted to allow same-sex marriage by redefining marriage as a union between, quote, two people. Later in the show, we'll hear Reverend Partridge's own story about learning to unite his body with his soul. And we'll be joined by Joy Ladin, one of our favorite Jewish poets and the first openly transgender professor at Yeshiva University. But first, here to fill us in on the surge of support and the continued struggles for LGBT people of faith is our regular news analyst, Kevin Ekstrom. He's the editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, and he joins us in the studio today on Tuesday, June 24th. Welcome back to Interfaith Voices, Kevin.
It's always good to be here.
Now, I was struck this week by the number of religion stories that focused on LGBT issues. First, there was the action in favor of same-sex marriage by the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. Tell me, was there much debate at that assembly, or was this a slam dunk?
Well, it was sort of somewhere in the middle. What was surprising about this vote was that it was basically a 3-2 margin, which sounds a lot closer than it really is. But, I've been covering the Presbyterians for 15 years, and they've never had a vote that was so positive in favor of a change on gay policy. What has happened is two things. One, a lot of the conservatives who would have opposed this in the past have simply left. They've gone to other churches, other denominations. And so what's left of the Presbyterian Church is much more liberal than it used to be. So that's why it was a bit of a slam dunk in favor. The other thing that's happened is that the geography has changed on the marriage equality issue nationwide, where, 15 years ago, you didn't have any states that allowed gay people to get married. Now you have 19 plus the District of Columbia. So the churches are wrestling with new realities that they weren't faced with before. And I think that's frankly having an impact on the outcome.
And how many years have the Presbyterians been debating this issue?
Since Adam and Eve entered the Garden of Eden, I think. they've been wrestling with this, I believe, at least since the mid-90s. It has been a perennial topic of every General Assembly I've covered since 2000.
Now, Presbyterians are, of course, part of this larger group we know as mainline Protestants. Mm-hmm. And so looking at that whole set of denominations, where do the rest of those mainline denominations stand on same-sex marriage? I know the Episcopalians obviously are in favor of it.
The United Church of Christ is on board. The Unitarian Universalists, if you would consider them mainline Protestants, are on board. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America allows same-sex marriage and also has its first openly gay bishop in the last year. The United Methodist Church is the largest mainline Protestant church and to date has held the line fairly strongly against moving in the pro-gay direction. However, just today we saw that the Methodist minister in Pennsylvania, who was defrocked for officiating at his gay son's wedding, was reinstated.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's actually a fairly major thing because the Methodists, for a long time, pretty much forever, have consistently voted to defrock clergy who break the rules. And this is the first time where they've said, yes, you broke the rules, but you can come back. That has not really happened before. So I don't know that it signals a shift in policy because the Methodists as a whole are actually still fairly conservative. And they have a third of their churches from overseas, particularly in Africa and Asia, which tend to be more conservative. But I think maybe what this does is signals a recognition in the church that there needs to maybe be a little bit more flexibility their pastors are saying, we're not going to obey this law. We're just not going to do it. We're going to marry gay people if we want. And so whether they change the law or come to some sort of accommodation, they're going to need to do something to keep everyone together under the same tent.
And then, of course, there's the story of Reverend Cameron Partridge,
yes,
who was the first transgender person ever to preach at the Washington National Cathedral. How important was that?
Well, you know, so we talk about LGBT, right? Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And I think a lot of churches have kind of come to terms with the L and the G part of that equation. You know, they know that there are gay people, they know that there are lesbian people, and they know that they want to get married. And now they're figuring out what to do with all that. But the bisexual and transgender pieces of that puzzle have been harder for churches to figure out. There's new resources coming out on the issue of bisexuality. You know, a lot of people just don't know quite what to make of it. You know, are they undecided? Are they greedy? Are they just indecisive? And so there's some movement on the bisexual front, but on the transgender front, there's been a lot less movement and a lot more discomfort, I think. People have a hard time wrapping their minds around the whole transgender issue. We saw this month the Southern Baptists passed a resolution saying, you know, transgender is basically doesn't exist and that people shouldn't try to change their identity. I think what Cameron Partridge at the National Cathedral does is it's a symbolic recognition that this community does exist, that they do have a voice, and that they're kind of finding their voice. And he happened to find it at the Canterbury pulpit at National Cathedral, which is pretty prominent. I think it's going to be a long time before the church really figures this one out. But I think what Cameron shows is that some churches are starting to wade into that discussion. And it's not going to be as clean or easy as the lesbian gay part of the discussion, I don't think. But ultimately, you know, something will happen there.
Now, not all the news in the last couple weeks has been really positive for LGBT rights. A group called the National Organization for Marriage held a rally here in Washington, D.C. on June 19th. And the Catholic Archbishop of San Francisco, Salvatore Cordileone, spoke at that rally. And I understand that the Archbishop's appearance provoked some really strong protests at home. What's the scoop on this? Who's this group and why these fairly prominent people?
So the National Organization for Marriage is basically the largest, most prominent group of folks who are fighting same-sex marriage. They, however, are on the losing side of this fight. And I, you know, I used to hedge that a little bit. Now I'm fairly confident in saying that they are losing this fight. So Archbishop Cordileone, the reason why he was there is because he is the Catholic bishop's point man on what they call defending marriage. But his real portfolio is fighting same-sex marriage. And so he came and addressed this rally. You know, but what was interesting was that, and I don't really mean this critically, but the speakers at this event were really B and C list speakers. I mean, you didn't have the Speaker of the House out there. You didn't have the National Association of Evangelicals or even really the Family Research Council. I mean, these were local pastors, most of them that nobody has ever really heard of. You know, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee were there, but it was a really small gathering. And when Archbishop Cordileone was invited and he accepted, there was a petition signed by tens of thousands of people telling him, don't go. The National Organization for Marriage is a hate group, which they actually have been labeled a hate group by some others.
And by the Southern Poverty Law Center, I believe.
Right, yeah. And, you know, they said, don't give the Catholic bishop's stamp of approval to this because this, you know, you're on the wrong side of history and this is just hate dressed up as religious freedom. But he went anyway, and he basically gave a defense and said, you know, if these people were filled with hate, I wouldn't be here, and I'm here to promote traditional marriage. But you know, I think the takeaway from that was how small the crowd was. It was really small.
So what does this say, though, about LGBT rights in the Catholic Church? Because Pope Francis is famous for saying, you know, who am I to judge, when he was asked about gay priests not long ago. But nothing of substance has changed. The teaching has not changed. This San Francisco Archbishop went to this rally and spoke.
Right. And, you know, frankly, I don't think the teaching will change, at least not in your lifetime or mine. You know, absent some crazy miracle or, you know, divine revelation. This is not going to change. I think what you may see is a change in tone, and that's really what Pope Francis has done. How the church talks, I think, is going to be just as important as what it speaks, because I don't think the speech is really going to change.
Overall, Kevin, how would you describe the religious scene today in general in the United States on LGBT rights?
You know, the political, legal, and social landscape on this issue has changed so rapidly. In fact, more rapidly than any other social issue that Gallup tracks. You know, there has been a 20-point swing in approval of homosexuality in the last 10 to 15 years. You know, you may see small incremental changes around the edges, but I think, you know, the Catholics, the Southern Baptists, the Mormons, they're not going to change their position. I think most of the mainline churches that are able to change their position probably already have. So I think we're looking at a bit of a stalemate in some ways. But what all religious groups are going to have to figure out is how they're going to exist in this new atmosphere that we're living in, you know, where people can get civilly married and they're going to come to their pastor or their rabbi or maybe even their imam, and they're going to present themselves for ordination or baptism, or they want to be a Sunday school teacher or whatever. And the churches are going to have to figure out how they manage that coexistence, because clearly, I feel safe saying this, the law is not going to be rolled back. Same-sex marriage is not all of a sudden going to become illegal, at least in most of the country. So how do churches and religious institutions exist in this new reality? That's going to be the thing to watch.
That's a lot to keep an eye on. So thanks so much for joining us, Kevin. Kevin Ekstrom is the editor-in-chief of Religion News Service. And after the break, we'll talk to Reverend Cameron Partridge and Professor Joy Layden about the progress and the roadblocks for transgender people of faith. That's next. We're continuing our conversation about the growing religious acceptance of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people. It's a diverse group, often called the LGBT community for short. A lot of people are now getting comfortable with those first few letters in that acronym. Recent polls show that nearly 60% of Americans now think that gay and lesbian relations are morally acceptable. But for many people, that last part, that T for transgender, goes beyond the pale. For some, especially in religious institutions, the transgender identity crosses a mental and spiritual line. Here to share with me their own stories are two guests, both trailblazers and transgender people of faith. Last Sunday, Reverend Cameron Partridge became the first openly transgender person to preach at the Washington National Cathedral. He's the Episcopal chaplain at Boston University. And Joy Layden is the first openly transgender professor at an Orthodox Jewish institution. She is a poet and an English professor at the Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University. Welcome to Interfaith Voices to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Joy, just so we have our terms clear, how do you define being transgender?
I try not to define being transgender very specifically. It's an umbrella term that's developed recently, and I think that the meanings keep changing as more and more kinds of gender identity and expression are finding articulation. My quick and dirty translation of it is transgender is anybody whose gender is more complicated than I'm a male or I'm a female.
We said in introducing our conversation that people are starting to really deal with what it means to be lesbian or gay, but they're having more trouble with transgender. Why do you think that is?
I think there are two basic reasons. One is that religion in general is a way of making sense of the things about existence and the universe that are most difficult to make sense of. And in our culture, the gender binary is one of the ways of simplifying and organizing a sense of reality. And we load male and female with all kinds of binary symbolism. So when somebody presents an identity that says, oh, yeah, the gender binary, that's just the beginning of a whole as yet uncounted range of possibilities, that seems to recomplicate the universe that many people go to religion to find ways of understanding. The other thing, though, is that religions are organized into communities, and in human communities, gender is at the basis of maybe all, but certainly the vast majority of social relationships. Gender is just woven in everywhere. So there's, I think, often a confusion in religious communities about whether discomfort with a trans person is a social discomfort or whether it's a theological discomfort.
And Cameron, what do you think is the larger meaning of your speaking at the Washington National Cathedral?
It's hard for me to fully wrap my head around what that meaning is. I feel like I'm going to be contemplating that for quite some time. But I get the sense that we've been emerging into a new level of conversation about trans people in the U.S. and around the world, actually. And the intersection of trans with religion sort of takes it into a new vein, and that may not be a combination that a lot of people have thought about together. So I think that it's just sort of taking the conversation to another level.
Why does it matter that it was at Washington National Cathedral? What does that venue mean?
Washington National Cathedral has a way of speaking to the wider U.S. context. I think it may tap into some older memories of, there are some folks who think of the National Cathedral as a sign of sort of religious conversation in the U.S. They may, for those who may think of the U.S. as a Christian nation, which it is not, the cathedral may carry some of that freight. But I think that it signals the intersection of people's religious lives and conversations in this country in a particularly deep way.
As you speak, it's sometimes thought of, because there are so many public services that are really part of what the government does. I mean, for example, the inaugural prayer service for a president is commonly held at that cathedral. Lots of funerals of important people take place there. In some sense, it's used as a spiritual center at a national level. So could it be seen that your speaking there was somehow a real breakthrough?
I definitely think that's the case, that somebody who's trans could be speaking about the intersection of faith and being trans. And in this case, it's also an Episcopal space. So I was speaking in a specifically Episcopal context as well.
And let's play a clip from that sermon you gave last Sunday now.
Nothing is covered up that will not be uncovered. Nothing secret that will not become known. Our reading from the Gospel of Matthew proclaims, what I say to you in the dark, tell in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim from the housetops. These sentences have quietly moved me for years, prompting me to wonder, what troves of trouble do we hear from God in the recesses of our hearts? What might it mean for us to tell them in the light? In what ways might God be drawing us into the project of revelation?
And Cameron, maybe you could expound just a bit on those lines from Matthew. Nothing is secret that will not become known. Is there a certain way in which you were thinking of really the whole LGBT community as you were speaking those words?
I was thinking about the season of Pride, which is part of the context in which I was invited to preach. I was thinking about the ways in which coming out is a form of disclosure. I was thinking about the Christian idea of revelation. And there, the passage from Matthew, which is using this really interesting language of covering and uncovering, really spoke to me about the ways in which our process of seeing one another or not seeing one another can be a profoundly creative, world-creative process. I also wanted to emphasize, and this came out more toward the end, that in a sense, as we see one another and as we name one another, we also shouldn't assume that we somehow see all of one another or somehow can name all of the humanity of another person. There's always a mystery there that I think remains there and grows over the course of a lifetime.
And Joy, remind us, if you would, of your own story, which I know you've shared with us on the show before. When did you first know that your body somehow didn't match your soul?
I started to become aware of it in preschool when I showed up desperate to play with other children after being cooped up with my mother for a couple of years, and immediately tried to play with my natural peer group, who seemed to me to be the girls. And the girls started giggling and running away because they didn't see me as another girl. It took me a while to catch on that they saw me as something different than I saw myself. But by the time I was in first grade, I was very aware that I was seen as a boy. I had to act like a boy. I had to be careful not to betray, to fail in my presentation as a boy, because I knew myself to truly have a female gender identity and was a girl.
And Cameron, when did that first realization happen for you?
Yeah, it's really hard for me to say. It sort of feels as old as the hills in one sense. And in another sense, it's hard for me in some ways to narrate my sort of awareness process, though I could narrate it in a kind of classic trapped in the wrong body sort of way. But it feels like somehow there's more to it than that. More than that, I don't quite know.
And you've said, Cameron, that coming to terms with your gender as a male was a profoundly spiritual process for you, as it is for many people. What do you mean?
Well, for me, coming out as trans, and I sort of experience, although I identify as a trans man and, you know, he, him, his pronouns, I also experience gender as more complicated than simply male for myself. I would say it was a spiritual experience in the sense that it felt like a matter of discernment. That's a term we use, you know, spiritual discernment. What is God calling me to? And so for me, the question was, how is God calling me to embody my gender? It's not, am I really a man or am I really this? Or, you know, it wasn't about applying a label. It was about growing in a very concrete, embodied way that really allowed me to embrace my body in a way that I never had before.
And Joy, was this acceptance of yourself as female, was this a spiritual discovery for you as well?
I'm not sure, because I experienced it as a very young child at the beginning. I didn't have a category for the spiritual. It was certainly something that I felt God knew and that I felt God had made me this way. God and I talked about it. When I became older and had read more things about the religious life, I thought, well, you know, in some ways this dissociation and detachment sounds like a spiritual experience and certainly the closeness to God. But the point of that is not to feel miserable all the time. You're not supposed to achieve spiritual transcendence and then want to die and plan your suicide. And that was the place where that I was at. So I was caught on what my best friend said, that I was like a negative of a photograph of enlightenment.
But you ultimately came to terms with this transgender identity, right?
Yes. Well, I never doubted it as the truth about myself. What I came to terms with was the need to live this identity. And when I accepted that, then I realized I had finally started the process of becoming a real person, and I needed to grow into a real person. And in a way, there were all these steps in spiritual and religious growth that I had skipped because I didn't feel that I was really there. And so when I started living as myself, I realized there were a lot of blanks to fill in and to grow into.
Cameron, can you give us your overall assessment of where the transgender religious community stands right now? Is it still in its early days, do you think?
I would say it is still in its early days, though it has been brewing for over a decade now. It's just now starting to kind of come more into the light. I would say there are several different traditions that have taken concrete steps to be supportive of the trans members of their community, like the United Church of Christ, which passed a lengthy resolution in support of trans people in 2003, and the UUA did the similar something similar in 2007, Episcopal Church 2009 and then 12. I know that there are folks, religious leaders who are trans in a lot of different traditions, Buddhist, Reformed Judaism, Lutheran Church as well. So I would say it's a time now where the grassroots work is bearing fruit in ways that I wonder if we could have imagined. We still have a really long way to go. But I would also say that trans people have been taking up their identities within spiritual and religious frames all along as well.
Briefly, what advice would you give to a person who encounters a transgender person for the first time? Now, this could be in church, in business, out in the world, anywhere. What should they do? Joy?
The first thing I would say is don't be ashamed of what you feel. Remember that those feelings, however difficult, are about you. They're not about the person. And when you recognize that, when you can separate what's going on inside you, wow, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to say, from the person standing before you, then you get to the next step. And here, I think religious traditions have a lot to tell us, which is that when a human being is standing before us, that's the most important fact. A human being is standing before us. However strange they look, whatever we know or don't know about them, as Cameron was saying before, we only, even with people we know well, there's always mystery. And the rule of thumb is treat a human being like a human being.
Joy Layden is a poet and an English professor at the Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University. Her newest book is called Through the Door of Life, A Jewish Journey Between Genders. Reverend Cameron Partridge is the first openly transgender person to preach at the Washington National Cathedral. He's the Episcopal chaplain at Boston University. Thank you both for joining us and sharing your stories.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.